All right, we're going to continue our lecture series on investing. Today we have the president of Logic Gate Capital, Mike Robey. Mike, thanks for coming in today.
No problem.
I just really wanted to kind of take a top-down look at what you do. I know just from doing a little research that you do a lot of value investing. Is that correct?
Yeah, we definitely consider our firm a value investors, much along the lines of Benjamin Graham, Walter Schloss, and Warren Buffett. Probably closer to the Buffett of the early 1960s than the Buffett that many of us know from the 1980s to present.
Okay. Well, maybe a good place to start then would be kind of talking how you came to be kind of a believer in that system, and then we can move into how you utilize that, because I think in the past when in your investing career you used to have a more technical approach to investing. Is that correct?
Yeah, we've kind of moved ways of doing things, partly just driven by experience and the results from our investing techniques. I came across what is deemed the Bible of value investing probably about 7 or 8 years now ago, called Security Analysis, the 1940 edition. And it was written by a guy named Benjamin Graham and David Dodd, who were both professors at Columbia during the 50s when Warren Buffett went there. And that's how he met Benjamin Graham. And so Benjamin Graham, just a quick history, was a Jewish immigrant, worked on Wall Street, I believe from the late 1918, up until 1955 when he retired, and kind of rode the great wave up to 1929, then experienced the crash in 1930, which prompted him to write the first edition of Security Analysis, the 1934 edition, about how to value invest, because he essentially almost got wiped out in the crash. He did survive. I think he was down 70-something percent during the crash. And so that really scared him. That made him think, we really need to come up with a way to, invest safely our money and really not take on as much risk to avoid, when these crashes do happen, to avoid kind of the situation he got into where he was down a lot of money and he wiped a lot of people out. Mm-hmm. So he wrote a second edition of the book, the 1940 edition, which is sort of the 34 edition, cleaned up a bit. It's a little more organized, so it's a little bit easier to read. And that's the book Buffett got a hold of in the, late 1940s. He stopped going to Warden, Buffett did, and went to the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And then he found this book, the 1940 edition, then wrote David Dodd a letter pleading to get into Columbia. And then he met Ben Graham there because obviously he had read his book.
So, and just for people that don't know, and please correct me if I'm wrong, then Ben Graham, and you had mentioned 1918 and 1955 kind of bookends his career. Is that correct, then?
Yeah, pretty much.
Along the way, then he taught at Columbia within that period.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah. So he was basically running an investment company after the 30s crash, and kind of worked his way back up and teaching at Columbia. In the 50s, while running this company called Graham Newman from the 40s and 50s. And Graham Newman was the equivalent today to be a closed-end mutual fund. It was a company, but all the company did was invest in other companies. And there was probably, 8 people working there. And the funny part about it was people would buy, it's very similar to Berkshire Hathaway, but much smaller, much less sophisticated than Berkshire Hathaway is today. I think a lot of the ideas Buffett got about Berkshire Hathaway came from Graham Newman because he was one of the employees there. Basically what it was is they would just buy shares of other public companies, and people would own a share of Graham Newman just to get the annual report to see what they were buying.
The underlying assets of the fund.
Right, because they knew those were such good deals because Ben Graham and the unknown then Warren Buffett were picking these investments. And so the returns on the Graham Newman Corporation were phenomenal, especially given the amount of 1950s and 1940s. There was no internet. All the research was done by hand. You had to wait for mail financial statements to come in. And so the whole premise of the company was that there was a lot more deals that I think because information flowed more slowly, but all of the premises of how that company invested was based off of this book security analysis that Ben Graham had written, some, 10, 12 odd years earlier.
Okay. And I know that through our conversations over the years, you've always kind of defined also your, for lack of a better term, your investment thesis, or maybe it's more of a philosophy, that when you buy shares in a company, you're really taking the point of view of buying that company. Was that something that they were doing in those days as well when they first started?
Yeah, that's actually the whole premise of security analysis, is that, a lot of people buy, shares in companies. You have your Cisco's, your Pfizer's. They think, it's just a stock, piece of paper where the price changes daily, based on whatever factors they come up
with. Sure.
Really security analysis saying, listen, if you're buying a share of a business and you have to value the whole business, and then that's how you determine whether to buy or sell shares.
Okay.
And if you're able to value the business, the shares are just basically a currency you're trading in, and that's all it is. And so the amount of shares, the price of the shares is really irrelevant. Whether a company has 200 shares outstanding or 2 billion shares outstanding, it doesn't really matter.
So you're looking more of kind of a, almost reverse engineering that price, seeing if it makes sense based on what you see, the fundamentals of the company, if the price makes sense.
Yeah, basically you ask yourself how much, it's real simple. You just kind of imagine in your mind, how much am I paying if I was to buy the whole company? And if the answer, if you say to yourself, well, this is a really good price to pay for this company, then you buy the shares. And if you say, well, if I was buying the whole company at this price, it would not be a good deal, you would not buy the shares.
Okay.
Or maybe if you own the company, and you say, wow, this is a really crazy price for this company on the high side, you'd say, I'll sell you my shares.
Sure.
And that's where another one of the main ideas of security analysis comes in, is really there's this character that they, kindly call Mr. Market, and he's a guy, he really is, it's kind of a metaphor for the stock market as a whole, but they personify the market as an individual.
And that's Mr. Market.
Mr. Market, right. And he is a great guy. And he stands ready to either buy or sell shares of any company on the public markets every day. And, some days he's very happy and he's willing to give you an extraordinary price for your shares. At that point, you'd be more than happy to sell it to him.
Mm-hmm.
Other days he's very sad. Outlook looks bad and he's willing to give you shares of the company he owns at a ridiculously low price and you're happy to buy from him.
Sure.
But most days, he's kind of just, blasé, and, there's really nothing to do, and he calls you on the phone every day, and you say yes or no to all these shares.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you start thinking about the market, it becomes very simple.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Mr. Market's offering me today. This is the price of the whole company. Is this a good deal or not?
No. Right.
Yeah, and you just go from there.
And isn't another kind of component of a philosophy or a thesis is sticking to that at all times? So in other words, that way you're always getting, what would you call it, good, consistent performance or consistent returns, as long as you stick to your thesis.
Well, that's the funny thing about value investing is that, yes, you're right about sticking to your thesis, but consistent performance is actually one thing that's not going to happen.
Okay.
The market seems to move, it's very schizophrenic. It's up, it's down. Most of your return will come from a few of your investments that you bought at outrageously low prices. And just in my experience, the biggest determining factor is patience.
Okay.
Most of our returns probably come from our best three ideas.
Out of how many would you?
Ideas we look at a year?
Well,
thousands.
Okay.
Thousands of ideas.
Okay.
I mean, and most of the time we won't even invest in something because it's just too, the prices look good, there's some problem with it, but overall, we do invest in probably, I'd say at all times, 20 or 30 companies, because we say these look good, but we have no idea what's going to happen in the future. And that's one of the key points, too, is that you don't know what's going to happen.
Sure.
All we can do is handicap risk, and we do that by looking at the financial statements and seeing what the business is doing. One of the key things about risk is debt. If a company has a lot of debt, it could go out of business,
mm-hmm.
Especially if sales drop off. They're unable to pay their debt. They go into bankruptcy. You're going to lose everything.
Right.
Whereas if you have a company that has no debt, has made money over the past 20 years consistently, has a product that's not really technology oriented. So let's say Clorox is a good example. People are always going to need bleach, and mm-hmm. they seem to be the market leader. They consistently make money. I'm not sure on the top of my head if they're leveraged or not. I doubt they are. And so they're able to, you know, there's safety there. That's another one of the key Ben Graham's key things is margin of safety.
Okay.
Is that you don't want to lose money. And that's also Buffett's rule number one and two. You know, rule number one is don't lose money. Rule number two is don't forget rule number one. So when you think about stuff that way, you know, you just try to set yourself up to have those, you know, returns. You know, you don't know what the returns are going to be. You just make sure you don't lose money. And by picking 20 or 30 ideas that you think are safe, you know, in our experience, you know, they might get bought out one day and be up 40%, or, you know, they might just rise over 2 to 3 years, you know, 100%, or back to book value or whatever. And that's how you're going to make your returns. Whereas the other ones, they most of them really won't do anything, but you didn't lose money. So overall, you've met the rule number one,
mm-hmm.
and you've made a return off one of the 30 ideas
sure.
you had.
Right.
And so that's where you get your return from. But the problem is it's very lumpy.
So it's kind of more about being available for opportunities then by constantly assessing.
You're just positioning yourself. You know, you're just making sure that you're not taking on a whole lot of risk,
mm-hmm.
and you're buying stuff that you think is cheap, and you're using that to basically go ahead and position yourself so that if someone does figure out what you think the value really is, you know, you're going to make money. And you know, typically you try to buy stuff as cheap as possible. You know, recently in March of 2009, I mean, stuff was selling at such insanely low prices.
Right.
You know, we were buying left and right. You know, our client composite for 2009 was up 64.6%.
Wow.
Against the market doing 26.4. That's because, you know, frankly, there was a lot of small companies that got sold off for non-economic reasons. Mr. Market was very depressed in those days.
Right.
That was just, they were giving us stuff at insane prices where, you know, if I was a rational owner of a business and someone came and offered me this price for my whole business as a private individual,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would have shut the door in their face or hung up the phone.
Right,
but,
right.
you know, Mr. Market got scared and, you know, we were able to profit from that. So, you know, 2009 is going to be an anomaly. It's going to be one of those great years you look back and say, wow, that was an amazing year for us.
Sure, sure.
You know, I wouldn't expect that to make 64% maybe ever even again.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's like, that was a once-in-a-lifetime scenario problem.
Sure, sure. So I guess, you know, before my saying consistent performance was a misnomer, I guess what I meant was is by sticking to a philosophy, you're able to kind of analyze your returns in terms of apples to apples then, right? I mean, doesn't it give you the ability, like, because if you start stepping outside and doing things you wouldn't normally do, then that kind of throws some...
Yeah, you're probably going to go out of business if that happens. So, you know, a good example of value investing, you know, the firm wasn't around, but was the tech boom in the late 90s. You know, when you start thinking about these businesses, you know, a lot of them, let's use Pets.com, right? Pets.com was essentially a tech company that had no assets and sold pet food. Well, if you do some research, you know, pet food's actually, PetSmart loses money on that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why pet food's in the back of the store, because they want you to go and buy all the toys for your dogs, which is the high margin products, in the front of the store.
Okay.
So what happened was they were selling the unprofitable product online. Well, that didn't work. And so that company was getting assigned billions of dollars of value. I think at one point they were actually worth more in PetSmart, the actual pet store. And so, well, from a value perspective, Mr. Market's asking the same price, and you just say no.
Right.
And so what happened was, you know, it was trading at, you know, 4,000 times, you know, non-existent earnings. The company never made a dime ever. You just stay away from it. You just walk away. Where at the same time in the late 1990s, you know, they were selling companies making, you know, I'm going to call it unsexy products like bleach and, you know, building products, cement and whatnot. You know, they were selling for 3 or 4 times earnings and they were trading below book value and they had no debt. Those are the companies you were buying. But in 99, you know, your fund would look terrible because,
right.
well, you've only made 12% this year and this guy's made 600 because he's in Pets.com and it's
and
gone
Qualcomm
up.
Qualcomm and everything else.
Qualcomm, so. Right, whatever else, right? Well, the issue is that, well, that guy who was up 600% now lost 99% in 2000
right.
when he got wiped out.
Right.
Meanwhile, you're chugging along
yeah.
at 12, and you actually probably had a good year through 2000 through 2002 because those unsexy sort of building product companies actually had a very good run, and you know, you probably made 12 to 20% each year.
Yeah.
So in the end, it worked out very well for you, and by sticking with that philosophy. But again, the returns are lumpy.
Sure.
You know, you kind of almost need that chaos in order to make, you know, your big returns. And so the 64% that I mentioned last year, I mean, I was not a I mean, I didn't do any better. I probably did a little bit better than some value investors, but value investing as a whole did very well, and so it's kind of gone back in vogue.
Okay. Well, it's very interesting. Listen, I want to thank you for coming in today.
No problem.
And I do appreciate your time.
Thank you.